Friday on the radio, a real mixed bag. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
But I always say that when I'm in those, sorry, my number three, every time when I say it in meetings, I'm like, we need naked men and women on the stage. And that's sadly, but you know what I mean? Like, it's something that you can go, wow.
Well, the seance is actually quite lovely, to be honest with you. There are many things that you can, candle flames will flicker very high. You can feel the presence of the people. You can also smell their scent.
And now I realize with the neurodiverse patient, I don't need him or her to conform for me. I will adapt the dental surgery for them and setting them up for a lifetime of positive dental experiences.
And we'll start with the Ryan Tuberty Show. And it was the morning after, so Ryan was commiserating with Eurovision contestant Brooke Scullion.
Now, poor old Brooke, by the way, I should mention the Eurovision. I was watching her last night and I was very proud of her performance. I thought she did really well. I thought the singing was great, the song was great, her performance was great. She had nothing to be disappointed in or ashamed of, far from it. I thought the staging was great. I thought this is going to be straightforward. And, you know, I watched the judge, the points come in, not the points, they just say the names of the countries that qualify one after the other. I couldn't believe it. I was really, really taken aback by not qualifying. So I don't know what we need. I don't know what we can do at this. We have thrown everything at this, everything, including, as I say, Brooke's performance last night, which I would have thought was, what do they want? What do they want from us is the question. So look, here we go again. Time to read. The drawing board is exhausted looking at us coming back to it. But it's where we return and see if we can fix it up. But anyway, how did not Brooke not get through, says Bernie. She was beyond brilliant. So proud of her and deeply disappointed she didn't get to the final, considering some of the acts that did make it. I'm baffled. You and me both, Bernie. Baffled.
Yeah, from the Ryan Tuberty Show. Then later, Thomas Cross, or Crossy, was talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes about the early exit for Brooke.
Do you know what? I'm gutted. I really am. You know what? Over the past couple of years, Ireland's sent over acts that haven't been really the norm of Eurovision. You know, they glitz, they glam. And this year, we did it. We did it with Brooke. She oozed the sexiness, the smiles, the happiness. I remember looking at her going, she's going to walk through it. Absolutely walk through it till Saturday.
So I thought so as well. And on the basis of one particularly unscientific thing, but I still think it's a good measurement, the applause and the reaction of the crowd in Turin, unless it was stacked with Irish people, which I doubt very much is the case, she got the best reception of anybody.
So I was talking to a couple of people over there in the last couple of hours, and they told me she did the rounds. She met everybody because everyone knows the Eurovision is such a massive family. She was going to gigs. She was meeting people from all over different countries. And everyone was like, this girl has something. They were calling her Derry Lipa after Dua Lipa. They said that's how good she was. That's her performance was brilliant. She looked like someone who's been on stage for years. So I think everybody in Ireland and in Europe this morning is going, why and how did she not get through? Because it was a bit of a snore fest. Like, usually the songs are uppity and boppity and, you know, you want to go out after a night out, after seeing it on Saturday. Like, Saturday's all ballads. It's all ballads. It's so, so strange.
You raised Dua Lipa there. Now, we're a daytime show. There are younger audience members listening, so moderate your language, please, Mr. Cross. But there's a Swedish commentator who said that she looked like Dua Lipa only on an Irish budget.
Wow. Now, that's a horrible thing to say. For people who don't know Dua Lipa, she sold out the Three Arena in about 2 minutes only a couple of months ago, and she played a few weeks ago. She's huge right across the world. And when I saw Brooke, I was like, that's who she is. You know, she's just someone that you feel like you have kind of empathy to, that you could have the crack with. And I think that's what the Eurovision is about. The dancers were brilliant. The choreography was brilliant. The staging. Like, you could have put that in the Three Arena tomorrow. I just don't understand.
Okay, you could, but I'm wondering, are we missing a trick here? Because as I was watching it last night, I had the Will Ferrell movie in my mind and I was thinking, do you know what? Will Ferrell didn't actually go far enough in his parodying of how excessive and how camp some of the acts are. And maybe that's the direction that we need to be going in rather than boppy poppy numbers.
Yeah, now I've been lucky enough over the past few years to pick out Irish songs for the Eurovision. So we'd be sent, you know, maybe 10 to 15 songs and we'd whittle it down to five. And then it would go on the late, late as it did back in February. Brooke was my number five. But I always say that when I'm in those, sorry, my number three. Every time when I say it in meetings, I'm like, we need naked men and women on the stage. And that's sadly, but you know what I mean? Like, it's something that you can go, wow. And I always get the look going, will you stop? This is not for your benefit. And I was like, no, I said... You have to bring it back to what it's about.
Eurovision is not your plaything.
But you know what I mean? I know some people was like, you know, the Norway act, you know, the lads are all dressed up in yellow dog suits. We sent Dustin over and it didn't happen. So you can't give out about Dustin, because I saw people saying, oh, it's because we sent Dustin over a few years ago. You can't give out about Dustin. Have you seen some of the other acts that have been on over the years? It's just, I don't know. It's very frustrating. And I love the fact that Ireland has come together in the last, 12 hours just to go, we need to drop out. Let's not do it again. They're terrible.
Crossy on Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. Then later, Ray Darcy was also looking at the Eurovision situation.
Where did it all go wrong? Were we robbed, or were we just not at the races? There's a stat I never thought I'd see. Ireland has only qualified for one final in the Eurovision since 2013. And North Macedonia won finals since 2012. So we are, with North Macedonia, currently bottom of the qualifying table. How the mighty fall. Now, mind you, if you want to rest and sit on your laurels, we still hold the record for the most wins. Sweden are nipping at our heels, and with that performance last night, it looks like they could, if they're not trumped by Ukraine on Saturday night, win it this year. But you have to feel sorry for poor Brooke Scullion, and we loved it, and we obviously loved it more than Europe loved it, and she was very emotional last night. We didn't get through 10 out of 18. We weren't one of those 10. I'd say we were just outside the 10. I thought myself it was always going to be a close enough call, and the call didn't go our way, and poor Brooke was talking afterwards.
Okay, so look, it didn't go our way tonight. We are so, so happy with what we did, and it just maybe isn't for me right now. But maybe in the future, maybe bigger things are going to come. I've literally got an EP coming out, like, who knows? Like, we're like, thank you so much to everybody who voted. I couldn't have done any more, and I'm so happy. So thank you.
We love you.
Overwhelming, very emotional. We spoke to her on Monday. Lovely, like really full of personality. So I think she's going to go far, despite what happened last night. And we still love the song.
That's rich. Well, it's coming from you, and that's rich. Well, I got nothing to prove. That's rich. You think I just...
They were all Eurovision this morning on Morning Ireland. Yes, the most listened to radio programme in the country. And Gavin Jennings, I didn't know he was a closet Eurovision fan. So he went all puntastic with Eurovision puns. Did you hear that this morning? Gavin.
In the next hour on Morning Ireland, what's another year? No speaker, no government, protocol problems and storm and stalemate. The latest from Belfast. Also, that's rich. Central Bank governor says ECB needs to act on inflation. Terminal 3, a year after the cyber attack. And that's what friends are for. The latest on the Wagatha case.
Hey! Was that four or five Eurovision puns on Morning Ireland this morning? Well done, Gavin Jennings. 12 points. 12 points for that performance.
From the Ray Darcy Show. Now, a trip to the dentist is daunting enough, but imagine just how difficult it can be if you have neurodiversity. Sensory issues can be triggered by bright lights and loud noises. So in the morning, Philip Boucher-Hayes was talking to dentists that specialise in care for people with autism and additional needs.
Autism is a condition that can affect how a person communicates with and relates to people around them. Many issues can arise in a dental surgery when treating an autistic patient, in part due to huge sensory overload that dental treatment presents. The Irish Dental Association are holding their annual conference this weekend, and Dr. Gillian Smith and Dr. Jennifer Collins will deliver a presentation on the best practice when it comes to treating patients with additional needs. Gillian and Jennifer join me now. Good morning to both of you, ladies. Gillian, can I start with you? When did you first become interested in this area of practice?
I guess the interest started even in my student days in working with people with additional needs. It was always something I wanted to do as I went through my working life as a dentist. And now I have a practice that is limited really to the treatment of people with additional needs and those who require sedation. So that would be nervous dental patients.
So talk me through how different your practice is to a normal dental surgery and how differently you do things. I mean, for a start, the physical layout, all of those bright lights that we associate with dental surgeons, is that something that you minimise?
Yeah, I mean, the reason dentists have bright lights is because you're trying to see into a little dark space.
Yeah.
We try to balance what we need to do as a dentist to provide treatment with making accommodations for patients with additional needs in whatever way we can. And in some ways, those are simple adjustments, but of course, we also add in sedation where it's required. You know, sometimes the amendments or adjustments that you need to make are straightforward. Sometimes they're not quite so straightforward.
How much more time do you have to spend with a patient than with if you were treating me, for instance? Is it about the time put in beforehand before you go anywhere near their mouths?
Yeah, and you've hit the nail on the head. That's really the issue. A lot of it is in the preparation before you even come into the dental chair. For lots of patients that I see, the time is actually shorter because they would find it difficult to tolerate a long session in a dental surgery. So you might be breaking the treatment up into lots of small, short visits rather than one long visit. Or if it works better in the other way, you might do some sedation and take a long session and try and get as much done in one go. So you're really tailoring the treatment and what that person needs depending on their own individual needs and demands.
I would imagine then as well, this is a good point to bring you in, Jennifer, that consultation with parents or with carers before you ever arrive anywhere near the surgery is key. Was that the case with you? Because you have a son with additional needs, is it?
Yes, that's right. So I have a son, James, who is 8 and the light of my life. So I've always had great empathy and compassion for autistic people in the past. And then all of a sudden, when I found myself to have a child with autism, it gave me a very different perspective. So I now would manage the autistic patient differently as a result of what I know as a mother to a child with autism.
And how did the prospect of having somebody rummaging around in his mouth strike James when you first explained to him the need for it?
Well, it didn't go down well, as you can imagine. So I had spent weeks and weeks and months running around my house with plastic mirrors and gloves and trying to acclimatise him to the experience of a dentist. But, you know, it's difficult for children with autism. And for us as dentists, we have to have great empathy for them and for also for their parents and carers who, you know, might find it very emotional and very, you know, understandably find it difficult to watch their child possibly be in distress in a dental surgery. But now I know more, you know, knowledge is power. Now I know a lot more and now I manage the autistic patient very differently. I'm much more accommodating as a result and I understand the emotions that the patient and the family feels. And I also understand more about the neurodiverse person. So like for me as a dentist, now I know that I, you know, the dental surgery is set up for a neurotypical patient, say. And now I realise with the neurodiverse patient, I don't need him or her to conform for me. I will adapt the dental surgery for them. So if they need to stim or twirl or squeal, whatever it might be that they need to do to regulate, I leave them at it. I might be doing the dental examination on the floor, on the windowsill, but at least I'm helping the child acclimatise. I'm having a look at their teeth. I'm hopefully discussing diet and brushing techniques and setting them up for a lifetime of positive dental experiences.
And Dr. Jennifer Collins spoke about training for dentists caring for patients on the spectrum.
It actually isn't. We're not taught special care dentistry in dental school. However, it's a skill that we learn over time. And that's part of what Gillian and I are doing with this presentation is we aim to empower, educate and enable dentists to manage the autistic patient more effectively in the dental surgery. So, you know, we aim to give them the tools and strategies they need to hopefully manage the autistic patient throughout their life then and make the whole dental experience more autism friendly.
How often do you end up having to use sedation, Gillian?
It's an interesting question. Really, autism is a spectrum, so you're going to have a very wide range of abilities with an ability to tolerate dental treatment. I would use sedation, I guess, because I'm a referral service for dentists. I would use sedation probably more than the average dentist would need to use sedation. It's great to have it as a as an adjunct to care, but we only use it when it's necessary.
Is there an ethical question attached to using it, though, on somebody who can't give informed consent about what it is involved in being knocked out? Or is this ultimately in their best interests that their dental hygiene is maintained?
Consent comes into it. We are working with the new developments in this area. The Informed Decision Making Act is something that, you know, that is coming to the fore and certainly will be a very much of relevance to me and my practice, where some of my patients may struggle to give their informed consent, and we'll work with the developments in that area as best we can. But you have a duty of care as a dentist to make sure that somebody isn't in pain or suffering with infection.
Jennifer, that's a really thorny one. How would you even begin to explain to James, I'm going to take you to the dentist and we're going to knock you out, but it's for your own good?
Yeah, that was a tough one, you know, and I guess for my son, there was a lot of the devil was in the detail. You know, I had to go through it with him in detail in advance. And I knew he wasn't too happy about the situation, but he knew it was for in his own best interest. But when my son had to have dentistry last year, he had to be put to sleep for his dentistry because I knew he wouldn't manage to have it done in a normal dental setting, so to speak. So we had to go into the private sector to get those services for him because they weren't available for him through the HSE. So thankfully, I have a lot of connections being a dentist, and thankfully I have the resources to afford for him to get the necessary services. But it's still, the costs were high with that. It still ran into the thousands. But and a lot of families can't stretch to that. But,
okay, so is that because you need an anesthesiologist present for the duration?
Correct, yes. Right. Yeah. And because the HSC wouldn't see autism as a medical condition, he wasn't able to get his dentistry done through the HSC. But thankfully, we were able to get an excellent service in the private sector.
Good. Gillian, is that a dilemma that arises for an awful lot of people, that classification of autism?
Yeah, if you're talking about that difficulty accessing care,
yes.
That's something that I face every day in my practice. You know, I'm working within the private sector and I really enjoy working in this field and I find it very fulfilling, but in an ideal world, I would be the private sector that people elect to use if they wish to opt out of the public sector. But unfortunately, people really struggle to access care for their children or family members with autism. I'm talking children and adults. And so they are having to, you know, find the resources themselves to access care privately.
And what sort of costs are we talking about being involved here? I mean, once you bring an anesthesiologist into the equation for an extraction, what are we talking about?
Well, once you are talking about admitting somebody to hospital for general anesthesia, you know, if you are lucky enough to have health insurance, that may contribute to the cost, but you are talking about thousands. When you're talking about conscious sedation, which is what I do in a primary care setting, you're probably not talking in the thousands, you're talking more in the hundreds, depending on the treatment that you're...
I know, but when you consider how frequently young children require extractions, I mean, God, one of mine had five extracted. If that was five separate hospital visits under general anaesthetic, you're talking tens of thousands.
Yeah, and, you know, access to dental care and, you know, elimination of infection and pain should be a basic human right. We as a state should be looking after the most vulnerable in our society. And this isn't something that people should be struggling to find access to. But unfortunately, that is the current state of play. And it's something we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis where people are struggling to find access for their family members.
Doctors Jennifer Collins and Gillian Smith from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And it was seances and different types of beliefs that dominated the live line with Joe Duffy.
In the Irish Independent today, one of their columnists, well-known columnists, Martina Devlin, she launched a book last night called Edith. And you would have known, wasn't it, Edith Somerville and Martin Ross. Martin was a woman, by the way. Violet Martin was her name. And they wrote the Irish RM, you know, that TV series. And after Miss Martin died in 1915, Edith kept writing as the two of them, so to speak. And the way she did it was she tried to contact her other half, so to speak, of her writing duo through seances. And Martina mentioned that she tried to go to a seance. I didn't know there was such a thing in Ireland. She went to the Dublin Spiritualist Society. Never heard of them. And they told her, no, you can't come to a seance. You're a journalist. Well, anyway, Martina didn't see that coming, but they... So I mentioned seances, and Brendan Murphy contact. Brendan's from Cahersiveen in County Kerry. Brendan.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
You believe, like me, this is a load of tosh.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it is a very dangerous load of tosh because it is the other bio that is the root of that. Today, we're not checking anything at all of what's behind anything that we go into, really, and that's where we're falling down. So, like someone asked me there recently, and no, don't get me wrong, okay. I'm a Catholic, but a very poor Catholic. I go to Mass because I'm a sinner. And it shook up a person one day when I said that, because sometimes I point the fingers at ones going to Mass today. There are a lot of people laugh at the church and mock it. But we in the Catholic Church, we don't put our faith in man or woman. We put our faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. Mm. I don't go around preaching and roaring about our Lord Jesus. He's my best friend.
You mentioned earlier the other, this is the work of the other bio. Who's the other bio?
The other bio is Satan, Beelzebub, Lucifer, call him what you like. He's darkness. You have Jesus, who is the light. Jesus redeemed each and every one of us on the cross. If Jesus didn't make it to the cross, we would not be here today. We would be under the other fellow's influence, because Jesus was tempted and God loved us so much that he gave us his only son. Mm-hmm. And every drop of Jesus' precious blood that was shed for us, every curse and every sin was nailed to the cross. But you still have the other bioactive. He can only manifest in one place, but his legions of angels can manifest for him in other places, the same way as Jesus is present everywhere. But Mary, our best, what happened to Satan was he was Jesus' most beautiful angel, and pride got the better of him.
This is Beelzebub.
Yeah, Beelzebub, Satan, the same fellow. Pride got the better of him because he could not stand when he was told that Mary, our Blessed Mother, was going to be mother to you, to me, and to all of us. And that vexed that little bio. And the reason I say little to him, I don't have no problem standing up and talking, and about him and telling him how evil he is, because he's only out to wreck and ruin. And the seances and that, I got to know about them really through my uncle, and that my uncle he was a Mill Hill priest. Mm-hmm. He performed exorcisms as well in Westminster.
So that's Brendan. Then Reverend Jeremiah Claiborne called Joe.
Where are you based, Jeremiah?
I'm in Ardra.
In County Donegal.
County Donegal, yes.
But you have been to seances.
Absolutely.
And are they the work of the other bio, the devil?
Not even in the slightest.
Liar.
Okay, tell us why, Jeremiah.
Well, first, people have this misconception that a seance is what you see in television and on movies, and that's actually not what a seance is. Mm-hmm. I was talking to one of your producers earlier today, and I said, seances happen in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of taken aback by that, because I said, have you ever heard of slain in the spirit? And he said, no, what is that? And I said, that is when they channel. Mm-hmm. That is what a seance is. A seance is channeling. So this whole idea of it being evil or it's the other boyo, that doesn't bode well.
Tell me where in the Catholic Church they conduct seances.
Well, that's what I was talking to your producer about. I was talking to him about...
Well, talk to the listeners about it now, yeah.
I was talking to him about slain in the spirit. Now, what that is, it's a religious practice wherein people start speaking in tongues and they channel the word of God to be able to remove darkness from someone's life. It's still channeling. You can dress it up any way you want, but it's the same principle as seance.
Okay. And what church do you belong to, Jeremiah?
I'm an interfaith minister.
And what does that mean? What is, so all, that all denominations?
So basically, yes, I have studied all world, well, major world religions, and we focus on the commonalities rather than the differences.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a...
And I want to make it...
Okay.
And I want to make it very clear here that seance has been a part of other world religions for a very long time.
Yeah.
Right? So in African Yoruban traditions, there is a lot of channeling, they call it mounting, of spirit, which is the exact same thing. So when I hear that it's being used by the other Boyo, it's kind of disrespectful to other belief structures who actually hold them in very high regards in their religious belief structure.
Can I comment on that, please?
Brandon, yes.
It is not disrespectful because all I can do is speak the truth. And the truth comes from our Lord Jesus, who has... I left you speak now, please. With due respect now, please. Channeling is a trance-like state, a method of communicating with ascended masters and other departed spirits. We are not told to communicate with our dead. If any person has recourse to the spirits of the dead or to magicians to prosecute themselves by following them, I shall set my face against them. Leviticus 26. There must never be anyone among you who makes a son, a daughter, who practice divination, sorcery, fortune teller, observer times, horoscopes, who use magical powers, spells, charms, a witch who calls up the dead, who consults spirits, guides, mediums, a wizard. This is not the gift that God gives to you. Deuteronomy 18:10-15.
Brendan, again, with all due respect, and I know I have to interject here, because of the fact that that would be perfectly fine and dandy if Christianity was the only world religion. There are many world religions, and sorry, let me finish now. There are many world religions that Jesus Christ is not their personal Lord and Savior.
He most certainly is. That's where
no,
you
I don't. I don't.
No, he is Brandon.
Brandon. No, there is the beginning and the end, Alpha Omega. There is
absolutely
light. There is darkness.
Absolutely.
There is truth, and there is
absolutely
light.
Absolutely, and that
Catholic
is also
Church,
found in.
Let me speak
Brandon.
Now, please. In the name of Jesus, let me speak. Let me speak. In the Catholic Church, we do not do seances. We rest in the Holy Spirit. A priest prays over us. And if you want to rest in the Holy Spirit, you can. But you won't be shouting and roaring. If you're shouting and roaring, there's a spirit in you, a spirit that is not clean.
But Brendan, Jeremiah's point is, okay, that's what you believe is the one true religion, the Catholic Church of Jesus Christ, though he's a prophet and a saviour in other churches as well. But Jeremiah's saying there are other universal churches who don't believe Jesus is the Messiah and Jesus
Correct,
is God.
But that doesn't change fact. The fact of the matter is that we'll all have difference of opinions, but one truth.
Absolutely, Brendan. We all have our own belief. There are many ways to the divine as our blades of grass in this plane of existence.
And Joe asked Jeremiah what happens at a seance.
Well, a seance is actually quite lovely, to be honest with you. There are many things that you can... Candle flames will flicker very high. You can feel the presence of the people. You can also smell their scent. Mm-hmm. There are many different variables that can come into play when doing a seance. And yes, there are some points in time where it gets a little hairy, but that is also
well,
when...
Tell me how it gets hairy.
Well, you know, doors may slam, lights may flicker, things may move. But that's normally when the spirits are not being...
So what?
Pardon?
So what? Candles flicker all the time. So what happens at a seance that's different?
Oh, no, when I'm saying flicker, I don't mean flicker by way of what you think is that they flick. I mean the flames will go very high, extremely high. You will hear voices in the room. You can hear breathing. There are many different things that can happen, occur in a seance, wherein if you're in one, you will definitely know. My grandmother was a medium.
What is the purpose of a seance? I'll come back to your granny in a minute. What's the purpose of a seance?
To communicate with spirit and soul.
And what, to communicate what?
Well, just for enlightenment, gaining better understanding. Let me put it to you this way. When somebody prays for guidance, mm-hmm. or, you know, has religious experience, when there is, you know, Christianity associated with that, it's considered all fine and dandy. But when there's any other religion that is outside of that, it's the same thing. There's
no, I want to go back to the seance, which is where this conversation began. Apart from candles flickering, doors slamming, people breathing, what happens mm-hmm. at a seance?
You commune with spirit. You commune with the gods, the goddesses.
And what does commune mean? Do I speak to them? Do they speak to me? What do they
say? Absolutely, yes. You speak to them. You can use Ouija boards. Tarot cards.
Oh, good God.
Dear God is right, Joe. Dear God.
But yeah. Why is a Ouija board such a concern for people?
Can I come in there?
I don't want people messing with
Ouija. Ouija is French, jazz, German, both meaning yes. And it goes back to 450 BC. People became interested in the occult. And that is the purpose of the Ouija board.
Okay, now I want to come Brendan, you asked Jeremiah then about the seance.
It is dangerous for... Because
no, ask him questions.
Yeah. Well, I don't need to ask him questions.
Well, I do. Okay.
I follow my own God.
Jeremiah, you say you commune, what do I... Do I feel better? Do I learn more? Am I more relaxed? How am I after a seance?
My concern is this, right?
Why would you want to contact the dead? Why would you want to contact them? You must let them rest. So why contact them?
Jesus is dead.
He rose 3 days after, mate.
Stop for one second.
Why do you want to contact
the
dead?
Sir, would you let me answer the question?
Answer it, yeah, please.
Okay, so first and foremost, I get where you're coming from and I can understand your aggression towards me.
Come on, answer the question, please.
Right? Okay. So, why would we want to contact the dead? Okay. We contact any person that is doing any kind of spiritual work mm-hmm. will contact ascended masters.
Let Jeremiah finish.
Buddhists do this. Taoists do it. Right? Islamics do it. Sufis do it. Right? Judaism, they do it. Why is this such a concern? When there is not a religious connotation to it, that is one of the major world religions.
Well, would you go
to a mosque and tell someone that they should not be worshiping a false idol because there's only one Lord and Savior?
If they ask me for advice, but as I said at the very start of the program, I'm a Catholic and a very poor one, and I admit that, and I don't go shouting from the rooftops telling this one that you should be doing this or that, but I was asked
to
come on the program.
Well, I was baptized Catholic too, and my godfather was a Catholic.
So answer the question now, yes. I will not shout and roar at anyone to tell them they should be worshipping this or that. You have free will. That's what Jesus gave you, free will. Blessing or curse, you choose.
Brendan and Reverend Jeremiah Claiborne from The Live Line with Joe Duffy. And on today with Philip Edger Hayes, the so-called Wagatha Christie libel case.
One of the country's most famous defamation lawyers, Paul Tweed. Paul, we brought you on to talk about the Rebecca Vardy versus Colleen Rooney trial, wending its way through the courts at the moment. At the outset, this appeared pretty straightforward, but it's not looking that way at the moment at all, is it?
No, absolutely not, Philip. I mean, certainly, so far as the case is concerned, it's a tabloid dream. I mean, it's been creating headlines and news for the Red Tops beyond their wildest dreams.
And the mid-morning radio shows, it has to be said as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit of a light relief for some of the lawyers as well here, but I obviously can't talk about the actual case itself because it's a live case and sub judice. But the basic principles involved are interesting in that the costs alone in this case are eye-watering. I mean, we're talking about a million plus sterling on either side, and not dissimilar to Ireland, in England, all costs are not recoverable by both sides. So the taxing master, you know, may only allow, say, 70% of the actual costs in. So it means that no matter who wins and who loses, there's going to be a six-figure deficit in costs. And that's an important factor to bear in mind, because in Ireland here, we have been debating at length, and the Minister for Justice has produced a defamation bill that has been focusing on the high level of jury awards in Ireland. But interestingly, this case is being tried by a judge alone. It has been run under the 2013 Defamation Act, which is supposed to be the template for all other countries to follow. And yet, you know, we have a situation where the financial implications of the case, regardless of the outcome, are going to be astronomical.
So
the legislation hasn't done much to stop that.
Would I be correct in assuming then that it would be open to the judge to say, hypothetically, because I know you don't want to be drawn into specifics, but hypothetically, Rebecca Vardy, yes, I see that your reputation was somewhat diminished by Colleen Rooney, but I'm only going to award damages in the order of £1, and you have to pay your own costs. You each have to pay your own costs, which would be an awful punishment on both of them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're sort of referring back there, Philip, to the Albert Reynolds case many, many years ago against the Times, where he was awarded £1. No, I don't know. As I say, I can't comment, and I don't want to comment in this specific case, but that sort of outcome is very, very unusual. I mean, normally, you know, people were debating a similar potential scenario in the Johnny Depp case that he brought against the Sun. But invariably, particularly where a judge is sitting alone, I mean, and this is a very experienced judge, you know, she will know exactly what she's looking for in terms of the evidence. And I don't really see that sort of scenario happening. But who knows? At the end of the day, what you know, mustn't be lost sight of is the fact that the legal costs here are the main financial burden, rather than the actual award of damages. You know, really at the end of this, a lawyer talking, I act for both newspapers and for plaintiffs, and I'm sort of, I always have to keep swapping my hats around and trying to remember which side I'm acting for at any given time. But, you know, it's very, very hard to, you know, to recognise and justify maybe the level of costs involved
okay.
in these types
well,
of cases.
Well, that, both representing plaintiffs and defendants, means that you're absolutely perfectly positioned to answer my next question, because I think people might keep on forgetting in this particular case that it was Rebecca Vardy who brought the action, given how badly things are going for her again. Do the addition on this for me, will you? Get out your back of an envelope and your calculator. What's the bottom line here?
There's going to be, you know, several million involved, several million plus involved in costs alone. Damages.
Now several million technically can be 2 million up. Can you be a bit more specific? Yes. I mean, are we talking 5-6 million?
Well, I certainly think it'll be 2.5 million upwards. You know, and it's as I say, the courts or the taxing master will pare a lot of it back. But you've got to bear in mind, particularly because of Defamation Act in England, there are quite a few preliminary hearings running up to this case. Now, they're good in one sense, in that, in theory, they knock down the substantive trial time. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, any time there's a legal issue, lawyers have to get paid. And that is one of the reasons that these costs are rising so high in England, which we are not exposed to as much in Ireland. You know, Ireland, the problem, the concern still seems to be focused on the high jury awards. And I'm fairly neutral in that. I mean, I'm comfortable whether it's a judge alone or a jury in most cases. But, you know, it's the actual procedures that are running up and have the financial implications.
Paul Tweed from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And in the morning, writer Joe O'Connor was Ryan Tuberty's guest, and it was an historic and emotional moment.
We did something today that you haven't done for 2 years, just a second ago. A very simple act that is done by humans every day, sometimes 10 times a day.
Yes, we should probably specify.
I think now we should.
Yeah, we shook hands. So you're the first person I've shaken hands with in 2 years.
That feels so strange to hear.
Yeah, well, I actually got to the point where even, you know, if you're watching something on the telly, if you're watching a drama where people met and embraced or shook hands, you're going, oh, geez, should I ring Neffet, you know? So it's been a very long, strange time for everybody. I heard what you were saying earlier about 18-year-olds and... it's lovely to come in today, but it's actually lovely just for that reason, because it's already been a bit like therapy for me. I thought I was the only parent in the world who was thinking, I'm not ready.
Yes.
I don't know how it happened that my 16-year-old suddenly got to be 18.
That's
my
it.
Son Marcus is 18 on Monday. Great. And, you know, he's doing the leaving cert soon. He wants to go to college in another country. And I am just about getting my head around him, getting the bus into town, you know.
Yeah, I do.
So, it has suddenly crept up on us. It's been a very trying time for teenagers. 2 years is a big chunk of your life when you're only 17 or 18. I think they've been marvellous. You know, their patience and their fortitude, that business of learning over Zoom, where you know you're looking at a flat screen, so challenging, very challenging for the teachers as well. You know, I have a day job where I teach in the University of Limerick, and I think every really good teacher wants to be in the room with the students.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
every teacher knows, or everybody who works with a group of people would know. You would know presenting the program. There's a whole layer of communication that is nothing to do with words. It's reaction and response, and there's an intensity of silence when people are listening.
Yeah.
And you kind of know when they're not, and you know when a joke doesn't fall flat, and you know, all of that. We pick up things through those kind of antennae, and they've been gone from us for so long. And then, I guess, there's the starkness of Zoom. Mm. You know, if you're teaching a class or having a meeting on Zoom, it starts at 11 o'clock, you know, there's no hanging around beforehand. There's no chat on the way in. Starts at 11 o'clock and it ends at 11:30. A student can't come up to you afterwards who is a bit shy in the class and ask you a question. You can't come up in the corridor and say, could you explain that? There's no going for coffee with colleagues, all of that. So I think I was very lucky, very privileged, because I've worked as a writer for such a long time. I know what it is to sit in a room by yourself. Mm. That's what a novelist does sometimes for months and for years. But I did feel an empathy for a lot of my colleagues at the University of Limerick and a lot of people teaching my kids and everybody else's kids, because I think a lot of a teacher's identity is actually bound up with being in a room. So it's great to get to this point, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
And the conversation swerved towards the area of parents becoming the pupils.
Isn't it lovely to overhear conversations of younger people about the house? And you're not eavesdropping. You're just making the dinner. You're hearing, and I find, or not even eavesdropping, but when they're talking to you about their lives, how educational that is for us at a certain vintage to go, oh, right, okay, so that's what...
Yeah.
Like they're really the link generation.
Oh, they are, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I've learned so much from my two sons. I better not say that too much now, because they'd start charging me fees for having taught me something.
By the hour.
My younger lad who I mentioned, he's a big classics guy. You know, you mentioned the classics earlier.
Yeah.
We were going for a walk around Paris Court recently during the lockdown. That was one of the places you were allowed to go. And there's all those classical
columns,
statues.
Statues.
Characters and Neptune in the pond and all that. But he was able to explain to me who all of these people were. And just that whole kind of reservoir of stories from the classical world. Really back in a big way. I see a lot of books about the classics doing very well. I don't know if it's a lockdown thing that maybe we all went back to an older kind of set of stories or an older... literature.
The old Greek myths have come back, but have been set in, like, Pat Barker, Baker. Is it Baker?
Barker. Yeah.
Which I loved the girls of Troy, the women of Troy, and the other one. But they were seen through a feminist prism, if you like.
Yeah.
And then a whole lot of young adult books, again, ancient Greece. So it's
all
back in. I was only saying to my youngest the other day about, I was celebrating the joy of an arts degree and how enlightening it can be. And just like your son, I was saying that, you know, I did Greek and Roman, whatever.
Yeah.
And no matter where you go in the world, you'll see a pillar or like your son with the statue, you'll never be bored. And you know, if you go and study law, you study law. Or if you study business, you study business. Or if you're an electrician, you're an electrician. But it's great if you have the opportunity to look at these, at the ancient world.
Yeah, Stephen Fry's books.
It's derided by people. Doing
very, very well about that. I think it's somehow related to lockdown and maybe having more time to read and maybe having more time to think about other kinds of storytelling than the ones we're used to. Anyway, it's an exciting kind of development for readers and a very good time.
And Ryan asked Joe about his new project based on the River Liffey.
So I watched a preview, Joseph, of the Liffey last night, which is the documentary that you wrote, which is narrated by Angeline Ball, the actor, but you wrote her script is not the right word, because it's much more than a script. It's actually beautiful. Isn't it like a love letter to the Liffey?
Well, yeah. I mean, the show is called The Liffey. It starts on Sunday night, RTE1, 7:30 for 6 weeks. And I suppose it's looking at the Liffey as a living character, as a living thing. I mean, in the very literal sense, the Liffey is a life system. It supports the insects and the birds and the animals and the clean air. And we wouldn't have the city of Dublin without it. But when I was approached to write it, I was saying to the producer and the director, there's an old tradition of embodying rivers or characterising rivers. James Joyce, who we celebrate this month, of course, the centenary of Ulysses, really the hero of his final book, Finnegan's Wake, is an Olivia, you know, the personification of the Liffey. And all Dubliners would know the phrase and Olivia, perhaps from the Irish Awen na Liffa. So there are moments in this documentary series where the Liffey speaks to us, and then there are moments where it's linking up a collection of stories from amazing people, a couple of dozen people who work on the river or who live by the river or who have an interest in it. Wonderful man called Christopher Moriarty, who has kind of spent his whole life walking the Liffey and thinking about it and studying it, and from him to a young man called Gary Riley, who's a crane operator in Dublin Port, who just talks about the sheer joy. I mean, it's so touching and inspiring. He says, you know, I go to work every morning. I climb up into this crane. I'm 30 metres above the city of Dublin. I might see the sun coming up and making the water of the Liffey golden. Nobody has a job like me. Yeah. And all of these people talking about the Liffey with great tenderness, like a kind of beloved relative.
Yes.
I mean, in the opening episode, which is on Sunday night, there's a wonderful sequence with a man called David Green.
Yes.
And he...
the job he has.
Yeah, he has an amazing job. The Poddle... The River Poddle flows through the Liberties, where my own family were from, under Dame Street and Temple Bar, and it enters the Liffey through a kind of beautifully built tunnel vault from the 19th century. And it's David's job to look after this. So, I mean, I would really recommend...
Yeah, he goes right down. He's lower down. He's 65 years old.
It's through an entrance hatch on Dame Street. And he goes down into this tunnel, which is so kind of spooky and evocative. It's the touch of Bram Stoker, actually,
who you mentioned in it. Yeah, but that's lovely.
So it's his job to look after this old tunnel. And he says at one point, you know, it's great, it's very well built, and I find it beautiful, but it's old and it's getting on. And like a lot of us who are getting on, it needs a bit of love and tenderness.
That's right, yeah.
And I was just so struck all the way through writing the Liffey by the great warmth and love and affection that Dubliners have for the river.
Uisce Fuí Chailibh, that's the term that jumped out. Uisce
Fuí Chailibh,
beautiful. Because as we were looking at David Green in his subterranean activities, I was thinking, wow, I could be walking along Dame Street and underneath there's a whole subterranean.
Well, there is. And I mean, Uisce Fuí Chailibh, the Irish phrase that means underground water, and it also means a conspiracy. You know, if you have an Uisce Fuí Chailibh going on with somebody, you're getting up to a bit of skullduggery. And there is a touch of that in this beautiful kind of shadowy, echoey vault that David is walking through. So, like, the footage in the Liffey, it's really beautiful.
And the drone footage, of course.
The drone footage that is available now, I can promise I hope that the words are beautiful, but I can promise that the stories people tell in the show are beautiful. Yeah. And the visuals of the Liffey. You will never have seen a depiction of the River Liffey like this.
Watching it from, especially from the sky, and as I say, the drone footage of it, it makes sense why Dublin, which of course, if in another world, we're Blackpool. I mean, Dublin, that's what we are. And, but what cities are built, of course, around what was the same, essentially the aquatic M50 of its time.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny you put it that way, Ryan, because for me, like my interest in the Liffey and my love for the river, it goes back to childhood. As I mentioned, my family originally were from Francis Street in the Liberties, mm-hmm. which is a 5-minute walk from the river. And I can remember my late grandfather, my dad's dad, who I always remember as a rather sunny, amiable granddad. I think a little bit more than he had been a father. You know, I think he was a fairly strict and somber father in those days, as fathers tended to be or thought they should be. But by the time I came along, he was a lovely man who had a kind of stoical love of the fact that in Ireland there is rain. He loved the rain. If it was a rainy day, he'd say, look at that liquid sunshine.
Yeah, I love after his own heart.
Aren't we lucky to live in a country where there's rain? And he would tell us quite seriously, he was a religious man and he meant it when he said, you know, it is a blessing for us. Wow. Some countries in the world, a lot of people in the world, they don't have water. And they struggle all their lives to find water. And we live in this country, we live in this city where it falls out of the sky.
And Joe read a beautiful poem celebrating the river.
This is a farewell, a few lines from Yvan Boland.
I praise the gifts of the river, its shiftless and glittering retelling of a city, its clarity as it flows in the company of runt flowers and herons, around a bend at Island Bridge and under 13 bridges to the sea, its patience at twilight, swans nesting by it, neon wincing into it, maker of places, remembrances, narrate such fragments for me.
Joe O'Connor reading Yvan Boland's Anna Liffey from the Ryan Tuberty Show. For an island nation, we're not exactly big fish eaters. And Philip Outre-Hayes had a theory as to why that might be when he was talking to chef Brian McDermott in the morning.
Sole, hake, mackerel, whiting, cod, haddock. Just a tiny selection of the potential seafood swimming around in our sea. But while many of us rave about our spring lamb or our fabulous beef, how many of us are confident and happy to cook fish? I'm joined now by Chef Brian McDermott with recipes and tips on how to create the perfect seafood platter. Brian, hello, good morning, how are you?
Good morning. I am absolutely fantastic. And it's a Friday, which just reminds me of my childhood when I was force-fed fish every Friday, whether I wanted it or not. Philip?
Do you know something? I think that we have to, in fairness, now people are going to say, oh, you're being anti-church and anti-Catholic, but the Vatican has to stand up and take some level of responsibility for the attitude of Irish people towards fish as a penance and not something to enjoy.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I think that's the very point that I'm making because, you know, from a young child, my mum, God love her, you know, cooking for 14 of us, had a pot of milk. And this guy in a car pulled up on a Thursday evening and no refrigeration. I would have been sent out to the boot of the car for a white bag that was the old butcher style bag that was tied on the top and this vibrant red fish inside it. So we referred to it as Red Fish Fridays. And of course, it was absolutely beautiful. And the milk was thickened with corn flour and it was gloopy and it sat over the fish. But you know what? I was safe. I was in my home. There was heat and we were getting a dinner. So
you were very lucky in Donegal, though. But for those of us who grew up like me in landlocked counties in Kildare, I associated fish with, well, there was always a terrible hum off the fish counter. And there just shouldn't be. I think that might be one of the reasons that people are still hesitant.
Yeah, I believe so. And, you know, it's funny when you're talking to people about fish, you know, they'll rekindle a memory that I've just mentioned, which is my memory. But then they'll go on and they'll say, you know, look, I don't like the smell or I don't like the bones or I don't know how to cook fish. So they've given up before even trying. And I suppose that's what we're going to try and change and champion here today, because interestingly, the smell does linger after you've cooked. But I will go to the point of, you know, if you're sourcing fresh fish, if you're lucky enough to get it, and it is readily accessible, I believe. We are an island at the end of the day, and, you know, we're not a million miles away from the inland point to the actual coast. And some of
our supply chains and our distribution is much, much more sophisticated now. You're talking same-day delivery from the moment it gets off a boat a lot of the time.
Totally, and then that's the thing about it, because you're looking then for a kind of smell that just is the sea, as if you're standing there, you know. There shouldn't be an off-putting smell to it. And they go into these sealer bags now with zips and everything on them. So don't worry about your beautiful car, the boot, or your gorgeous oven at home, you know. Food needs to be eaten and enjoyed, okay. And fish is a good, nutritious one.
Brian McDermott from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And now, ahead of a warm weekend on Morning Ireland, Samantha Labrary had some positive news for sea swimmers.
Now, some good news for a change, in particular for sea swimmers. A new report by the Environmental Protection Agency has found that Ireland's bathing water continued to improve in 2021. 97% of designated bathing waters met or exceeded the minimum standards, and only 2 out of 148 bathing locations have failed to meet those standards. Well, here to tell us more is Dr. Emer Cotter, Director of the Office of Evidence and Assessment with the Environmental Protection Agency. Thanks for coming into studio this morning. Is great news for sea swimmers, but what's it down to?
Well, really, what we're seeing, it is good news. We're seeing that nearly 80% of our bathing waters are achieving excellent status, and indeed 97% meeting the minimum requirements. And that is really positive news as we go into the summer. The bathing season will start on the 1st of June, and we can all enjoy our beautiful beaches and bathing areas around the country. What it's down to is what we're seeing is improved management of our bathing areas around the country by local authorities over many years, and also sustained and ongoing investment in our urban wastewater treatment infrastructure. And that is leading to improvement in our bathing areas. But some problems do still persist, so we'll need to work hard to maintain what we have and maintain that very high quality that we're seeing in our bathing waters, and also to drive further improvements and looking in particular at areas like diffuse pollution, so runoff from agriculture, and that happens particularly after heavy weather and heavy rainfall, continuing to address our urban wastewater infrastructure and ensure it's up to standard, and also dealing with contamination and fouling from dogs and animals on beaches, which is a particular issue around the country.
Tell us about those 2 swimming spots that didn't make the grade. What were the problems there?
So there's two areas that are rated poor, and that means they haven't met the minimum standards, and it's not advisable to swim there. And they're in Front Strand Beach in Balbriggan, and also Ladies Bay in Buncrana and Donegal. So in Balbriggan and Front Strand, there's a number of issues at play there in terms of misconnections and issues with the sewer network, urban runoff, and also contamination, fouling from dogs and birds on the beach. And I know they're working there. There's a local a plan that's been put together by Fingal County Council to address those issues. And up in Donegal, in County Donegal and Buncrana, the issue at Ladies Bay relates to the wastewater treatment plant in the town and stormwater overflows. And that plant has been added to the EPA's priority list.
Dr. Emer Cotter of the EPA talking to Samantha Labrary from Morning Ireland. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.